What's up, fools? It is March 31st, 2019. Welcome to the QTR Podcast. First and foremost, I want to shout out some of my patrons. Those are the kind folks that donate a recurring monthly sum through Patreon to support the podcast. First and foremost, my friends over at Quantamize, Quantamize. Quantamize is an AI-powered, quantitative-based research platform that allows the everyday investor access to over 10,000 stocks, options, and crypto. They were just rated by Benzinga as the number one alternative to the Bloomberg Terminal. So I want to shout out my friends over at Quantamize. There's a free link trial to them in the podcast description. I also want to shout out my friends over at Corvus Gold, my buddy Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground, Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, Russ Valenti, Piggly Wiggly's in the house, Nathan Weiss, Mike, Matt Merrill, Chris Sharkey, Jesse Collins. Thank you guys so much for continuing to be patrons, and just a couple of new patrons like my brother Colin Hicks, Rob Sittig, Fire Bruce Allen, M&M Research, Walter Berkowitz, P-Dog, Toy Pam, David Spots, Dale Short, all in the house. I'm going to cut this one short today, though, because I got a great interview coming up. Two other things. This is not financial advice. I am not a registered financial advisor in any capacity, so do your research elsewhere, fools. And then finally, there is a two-drink minimum to this podcast. It's Sunday. It's already noon. That probably means most of my listeners are drunk already. So Godspeed to you if that's the case. If not, you better get on that shit. That's all I'm going to say. All right. On the line with me today is my favorite economist and the chairman of Shift Gold, CEO and chief global strategist of Euro-Pacific Capital, and also host of his own podcast, The Peter Schiff Show. I have Peter Schiff here with me. How are you today, sir?
I am good. I'm good. Nice to speak with you today, Chris.
Yeah, it's awesome to have you back on. I was just telling you off the air, and I'll tell you again on the air, I really appreciate you taking time out of what I know is an extremely busy schedule to come back on the podcast.
Sure, and try to keep it clean. My 16-year-old son listens to your podcast when I'm on.
Okay. So. I will definitely keep it clean this time.
Clean it up a little bit, make it ready for prime time.
All right, fair enough. I don't know how you know, what type of primetime aspirations I have, but I appreciate you slumming it and coming on and speaking to me. So I got a bunch of things I want to ask you about. Obviously, uh-huh. I want to lead with what Guy Adami was talking about on my podcast that I did with him recently that I know that you sent me an email about. And for the listeners that maybe haven't listened to that podcast, Guy Adami is a CNBC contributor and a very nice guy who was kind enough to come on the podcast. But one of the things that I pressed him on while he was on the podcast was why CNBC doesn't have bears on as regularly as they have bulls on, or even just more prominently. And of course, Peter, I brought your name up because you're one of my favorite people to watch when you go on any type of media, especially financial media, because you're funny and you're well, you know, you make your arguments very well and you make very good points. And what Mr. Adami said to me was, you know, well, guys like Peter Schiff, they're not good for TV. And I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, well, that's why CNBC has their lowest ratings ever. The ratings were a lot higher than when they used to have me on regularly. Now, not that, you know, it's my fault that the ratings were better, but in general, I think if you're just going to bombard people with the same old nonsense day after day, you're going to lose your audience. You know, when I was a regular on CNBC, and, you know, I used to be on maybe once a week, and people used to, you know, recognize me in New York. I mean, you know, they'd see me and they'd say, hi, oh, Peter Schiff, you know, I love you on CNBC. And they would say, you know, the only time I turned up the volume is when I see you. So, you know, people used to like watching me when I was on CNBC. They used to get fan mail. I mean, they used to tell me that, you know, they would get a lot of positive feedback when I was on. In fact, they used to specifically try to invite me on when there was like a ratings, when they knew that, you know, there was like a sweeps week or whatever it was, but they would tell me, hey, you know, we want to get you on. And in fact, when they were doing a lot of their online content, in fact, one of the last shows I did on CNBC was Fast Money. In fact, that's, I think, about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago was my last appearance, and it was on Fast Money, which is, you know, the show that Guy's on. But, you know, they also used to bring me on quite a bit to their web version of that show, you know, and they would tell me the reason they would do it is because they would get more traffic. They'd get more hits if they had me on. So for a guy to say that I'm not on because I'm bad for TV or bad for ratings, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I know that I'm good for TV and good for ratings. Now, maybe the advertisers don't like it if they're just trying to sell a bunch of bullish stuff, or maybe some of the other guests. I know some of the other guests didn't appreciate, you know, getting shown on clips, you know, arguing with me, you know, from the Peter Schiff was White video. But, I mean, I didn't even have anything to do with that video. I mean, a third party put that together, and I saw it for the first time on YouTube. But, you know, yeah, I just thought that was a disingenuous comment. They're going out of their way, I think, not to have me or maybe other people that would express my viewpoint. You know, I do see quite a bit now David Stockman, and he's getting on CNBC and Fox, and you know, he says a lot of the same things that I do, not exactly the same things, but one of the reasons that I think that they have David on and not me is because he's not giving investment advice. He's not right. affiliated with a broker dealer or an investment management firm. So he's not really trying to tell people what to do. He's, you know, he's just a political commentator. He used to be part of the Reagan administration. He was at OMB. He's written a book. And so he kind of comes on, but really there's nobody from this industry that is coming on with a financial background that is saying the stuff that I'm saying, or anywhere near what I'm saying. And, you know, they allowed me to come on their air and, you know, frequently invited me, you know, before the last financial crisis, you know, before 2008. And after the financial crisis, the invitations to come on, you know, kind of slowed down. I mean, they didn't abruptly stop having me on, although the first network to stop having me on was Bloomberg. They stopped having me on around 08 or 09. I used to do Bloomberg more than CNBC. I sometimes they even had me on for an hour, kind of like guest hosting one of the shows. And I used to do a lot of Bloomberg, but they abruptly stopped. So they were kind of the first of the major networks to ban me. But over time, you know, CNN stopped calling me. I used to do that quite a bit. Fox News I haven't been on in years and years. I still do Fox Business occasionally. So they haven't completely, you know, closed the door on me. But I used to do, you know, CNBC Asia. I used to do CNBC Europe. And they all stopped calling, too. The last time that I was supposed to be on CNBC was over 2 years ago. It was with Rick Santelli, who used to invite me on. Rick and I are kind of friends, and, you know, I've known him for a while. And so he specifically would request me, you know, and I'd do the interviews with him. And they abruptly canceled the appearance a day before I was supposed to go on. They had booked it like months in advance, and then they canceled it. And then they've never tried to book me since. So obviously, Santelli's team didn't get the memo that Peter Schiff's not allowed on. But you know, it can't possibly be ratings. And I know that yes, I mean it's about ratings, but it's also about appeasing the advertisers or the other guests. And I just think that they want to shield their audience from my perspective. Now, maybe they actually think, well, I'm just a stop clock. I'm never right about anything. So, you know, why let people listen to me? Because, you know, somebody might listen to me and, oh my God, they might decide to buy some gold, which would be terrible. Or they might, you know, they might actually sell some U.S. stocks or maybe invest in foreign stocks. And, oh, that would be such a terrible thing if they actually did that, as opposed to just, you know, buy all the fangs or whatever it is they're constantly pushing over there. Or, you know, maybe they don't like people being, you know, critical of the Fed in the way that I'm critical, not the way that, you know, most people criticize the Fed. I mean, I criticize them in a way that, you know, you generally don't hear. But maybe they think they're doing a favor to, you know, their audience by, you know, keeping me off their air. But, you know, obviously, I mean, people find a way to listen to me anyway.
You'll know that that shit's going in the wrong direction at CNBC when Santelli's the next guy to go, right? Because even though, you know, you guys see eye to eye on some things, and Santelli has been critical of the Fed, you know, during his CNBC appearances, but I feel like I see him on there less and less. You know, I remember he used to go to war with Steve Leisman.
Well, he's still on a lot, Chris, but, you know, he's, like a lot of people, unfortunately, drank the Trump Kool-Aid. And so he's just, you know, a lot more, you know, much too bullish on the U.S. economy. I mean, when Obama was president, you know, he was more critical of the bubble economy and the artificial stimulus and more worried about a day of reckoning. I mean, he's the guy that, you know, you credit for, you know, starting the Tea Party, you know, by screaming, you know, on CNBC against the bailouts or, you know, against TARP.
Right.
But now that Trump is president, like a lot of other people who are Republican or lean Republican, you know, they want to pretend that everything is great because they think it somehow validates, you know, the Republican philosophy or capitalism or limited government. But the problem is the Republicans don't stand for those things. And by trying to pretend that the economy is great, you're not validating anything. You're simply making it easier when the bubble pops for the Democrats to blame capitalism, to blame the tax cuts, to blame Republicans, which is exactly what is going to happen. And unfortunately, you know, there's really nobody on the mainstream media really that has been criticizing the Fed or the Trump administration for the right reasons. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of Trump, but it's all for the wrong reasons. I mean, you know, a lot of the criticism is unwarranted, and I'll defend the president when I think he's being attacked unfairly, which is most of the time. But he's also being lauded unfairly. The economy is not as strong as the president is pretending, or Wall Street, or the media. You know, and the failings of the president are real, but that's not what he's being criticized for.
And you have to wonder how much of it, in terms of the media staying away from the narrative, is, you know, they're under direction to kind of stay away from it, and how much of it is just systematic indoctrination. And a perfect example is, you know, I just had Kenny Polcari on the podcast a couple days ago, who I love and is a top class guy. And I, you know, I consider him a friend, and we have very different views on things. Now, Kenny, he's been on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange for 38 years. Okay. So far be it, you can't get more engrossed into the industry than he has. He's literally standing at the epicenter of the industry for decades. And when I ask him about the Fed, and he talks about, you know, hey, I think, you know, rate cuts will come next. And then he says, you know, and I say to him, Kenny, well, what's next? And, you know, he says negative interest rates, you know, well, everybody else is doing it. And I say, but yeah, but what if, you know, what happens when that doesn't work? And like, what comes after negative rates? And he just doesn't have an answer, you know, and it makes me think that if somebody like him, who has been so engrossed in the industry for so long, like how much of the media, Peter, do you think is just taking the narrative to stay away from these types of talking points versus how many people just don't have a clue? I mean, is it just ignorance?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, whether it's ignorance or simply, you know, people have a vested interest to maintain their ignorance. So a lot of times it's just not wanting to recognize something, because to recognize it is so disruptive to everything that either you believe or your business model is based on. And, you know, people accuse me of the same thing. They'll say, you know, Peter, well, you know, your business model depends on you being bearish. And the reality is that I get that. But, you know, when I have a gold business, for example, Shift Gold, and I say people should have gold, what do I tell people? Have 5 to 10% of your portfolio in gold. I mean, that is not a crazy recommendation to make,
right?
You know, as opposed to other people who say don't own any gold at all. I mean, I think not owning any gold is, you know, makes no sense historically from an investment perspective or portfolio perspective. So yeah, you know, and I only started Shift Gold. I was recommending that people buy gold for many, many years when I was running a broker dealer, even though I didn't sell any gold.
Right.
But I wasn't making any money. I was referring people, look, go buy some gold. I mean, I didn't sell it, but I said, go out and buy it, you know, from other people. It was only because I got a lot of horror stories from my clients who would go buy from other people, and they'd end up overpaying. They'd end up being bait and switched into some numismatics. So at that point, I decided, you know what, I'm just going to sell it myself. And that way, I make sure that, you know, people don't, you know, overpay, and they don't, you know, I just, you know, I get them into the right bars or coins. But, you know, by the way, too, people keep saying, oh, if Peter Schiff likes gold so much, why is he trying to sell it? I'm not selling my gold. I mean, people make they can't differentiate this. I'm simply acting as a middleman to help people buy gold. I buy it wholesale and then sell it retail. I don't sell my own personal gold. I continue to buy gold and silver for myself. So I don't sell my gold to my clients. I help my clients buy gold from other people who are selling theirs. and I take a small, you know, commission for, you know, for the transaction. So, but then also, you know, in my broker dealer, my brokerage form, you know, nothing would make me happier, really, you know, to just go all in on the U.S. stock market. And, you know, obviously, had I advised people to buy U.S. stocks, you know, 5-6 years ago, instead of the foreign stocks that I recommended, you know, on paper, we'd have a lot more money now. But that's only with the benefit of hindsight. I still believe that in the long run, I'll be vindicated and that the foreign stocks that I own are going to end up, you know, substantially outperforming the U.S. stocks that I did not buy. Now, of course, I wasn't recommending that people short stocks, so people overlooked the fact that, hey, I haven't been, you know, telling people for all these years, get short, get short, get short. I haven't said that. So it's not that, you know, I'm losing money as U.S. stocks rise. I obviously could have made more money on U.S. stocks in general. I mean, I've had some foreign stocks that have done exceptionally well, you know, and so on individual stocks, I've had some, you know, huge winners over the years. But I guess overall, on a, you know, if you just average out all the stocks, the foreign stocks haven't done as well as the U.S. market, mainly because of the strength of the U.S. dollar, which I believe is just temporary and it's just a bubble. But I could just as easily, you know, put my clients into domestic stocks as foreign stocks. I'm managing money, and you know, I can get paid to manage domestic stocks too. It's just that I think that people will make more money in the foreign stocks, but I get accused of just touting that because that's, you know, I'm making a living as a global stock, you know, portfolio manager. But I'm only doing that because that's what I feel is the right thing to do. But the reason I bring it up is that you never see the bulls face the same criticism. Like when Guy Adami was talking about how I'm kind of rude or something like that, I wasn't
abrasive.
The one that was rude.
He said abrasive.
It was the guys like Scott Nations that they would put on. They would invite me on, and then this guy would immediately attack me, my objectivity, my credibility, basically say I'm a crook, I'm a con man, and then I would be on a defensive. But I pointed out, I think on my last appearance, I said, look, you know, what about all the guys that were on CNBC in the late 1990s touting the internet stocks? I mean, no one was accusing them of talking their book or just hyping what they had to sell, or, you know, all these bulls that just come on, even to this day, they're constantly making up excuses why the U.S. stock market is going to go up. And granted, it has gone up. But, you know, when it collapses, right, nobody's going to be pointing out that these guys were a bunch of stop clocks. And the only reason that the market is much higher now than it was in 08 or 2000 is because each time the bubble burst, the Fed was able to save everybody by blowing up a bigger one.
Right.
But, you know, at some point, the Fed's not going to be able to do that. And then, you know, the market's going to be down for the count. But it's all of these permabulls that are on CNBC or other networks routinely that never see any of the problems. And because the problems don't immediately manifest themselves, they believe that anybody who's been warning about the problems were wrong. And when the bubble finally pops and it's a complete disaster, well, they just say the people that were warning about it were permabears.
Right.
And they don't realize that the only thing that's saving them is the Federal Reserve repeating the very mistakes that they didn't recognize in the first place. And probably one of the best examples of how clueless everybody is look at what just happened with the Fed, right? The Fed surprised everybody, you know, I mean, when I say everybody, I don't mean me, but everybody that's normally on CNBC, right? All of a sudden, the Fed did a reversal, complete 180 on future rate hikes and shrinking their balance sheet. I mean, complete 180, 100%. And in fact, the last time I was on, or not the last time, the second last time I was on Fox Business, which again still has me on occasionally, so I guess hats off to them. But so I was on Liz Claman's show, and you know, she asked me, "What's the Fed going to do in December? You know, are they going to hike or not?" And I said, "Well, you know, actually, December doesn't really matter." Because I said, even if they hike in December, and they probably will, but even if they do, it's going to be the last hike they have. And the next thing they're going to do is cut rates. That's going to be the next move. And, of course, people said, well, that's impossible. Why would they do that? And I kept telling people talking about on my podcast, every time the Fed was saying, you know, we're going to normalize rates, we're going to keep raising rates, we're going to put our balance sheet on autopilot, we're going to shrink it, I kept saying, this is absurd. This is never going to happen. I was saying from the beginning, from before the Fed raised rates for the first time, I said they're never going to complete the normalization process.
Right.
From before the Fed shrunk the balance sheet a little, I said they're never going to shrink it. Like they claimed they were going to bring it back down to the pre-crisis level. I said not even close. They're going to give up. It's impossible to do this, right? So I'm one of the only people out there saying that the Fed is basically BSing. And there's no chance that they're going to do what they're pretending they're going to do. But the markets believed it. They bought the dollar. They bought the U.S. stocks. They sold gold, all based on believing what the Fed was saying. And when people would tell me, because I would say they're not going to do this, they would say, but the Fed is saying they're going to do it, Peter. I don't care. I said, I don't care what they say. They're not going to do it. Now, either they're just deliberately lying and they know they can't do it, or they don't know, but they're going to find out that they can't, right? Because I knew that they couldn't. So then the Fed finally does this. The finally does what nobody expected. And the markets kind of shrug it off. At least the dollar index is still above 97. Gold is still above 1,300. I mean, sure, the stock market rallied, and I predicted that that rally would happen. I said when the Fed did cave and came to the rescue of the market by backing away from the rate hikes and the QE, that that would spark a rally. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that coming. But I didn't think it would start a new bull market. I thought it would be a bear market rally, and I'm right. Still of the opinion that that's what we're going through. But my main point is that people do not appreciate the significance of what the Fed just did. And they still believe the lies that the Fed was going to normalize interest rates. They were going to keep shrinking their balance sheet. But something happened, right, to prevent them from doing that. And now they're going to be patient for a while because of some factors that were unexpected that developed. But again, that's exactly what I said they were going to do. I said they were going to wait for an excuse to abort their normalization and abort the quantitative tightening because I knew they couldn't tell the truth. See, the truth is they can't raise interest rates because we have too much debt. We can't afford
right.
a normal rate of interest because we have an abnormal amount of debt. They can't shrink the balance sheet because the deficits are too high. And if they did shrink the balance sheet, it would put too much upward pressure on long-term interest rates and, you know, it would collapse the bubble. So it's got nothing to do with weakness abroad. It's got nothing to do with Brexit. In fact, if anything, the problems in the global economy are actually making the Fed's job easier. That's what nobody seems to get. If the global economy was in better shape and people were more optimistic,
right.
that would be bad for the U.S. because as long as people are worried about Europe or China, for some reason they buy treasuries and they
right.
buy dollars. So we get a pass. We get to go deeper into debt. You know, we get to make the bubble bigger. So this is the only thing we got going for us. In fact, the funniest excuse that the Fed has made for the reason why they stop raising rates is when they talk about falling oil prices, which is hysterical because when they raised interest rates in December, which was their last hike, the price of oil was $45 a barrel. Now it's $60 a barrel. It's 33% higher.
Right.
Yet they're saying, oh, now we have to stop raising because oil prices are falling. They're not falling. They were falling when they hiked rates in December. They ain't falling now. In fact, if you actually go back to the bottom 3 years ago, oil prices are up 60% off the lows. That's 20% a year. I mean, so who are they kidding? But Wall Street believes this nonsense. None of this is true. But, you know, the dollar still hasn't collapsed. To me, you know, it's like the cartoon Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote has run off the cliff. He's off the cliff right now. He just hasn't looked down.
Right.
And, you know, the markets are going to look down, and they're going to see that this is a bunch of nonsense, that the Fed never had the ability to normalize interest rates, never had the ability to shrink their balance sheet. We're going back to zero. We're going back to QE. It's not, you know, 25 or 50 basis points of rate cuts. That's going to do nothing. They're going all the way to zero, and they're probably going to do it maybe in one fell swoop. I don't know, but we're going back. We're going to do bigger QE. QE4 is going to be bigger than 1, 2, and 3 combined. It has to be, because the budget deficits are going to be much larger.
Right.
I mean, we're already running almost $1.5 trillion a year in deficits, and we're not even technically in recession yet. So the next recession, we'll be talking about maybe $3 trillion a year deficits, which is going to require, you know, massive money printing and debt monetization. And the reason that the dollar didn't implode, the reason that gold stopped rising at 1,900 and then pulled back to 1,000 or 1,050 was because the Fed convinced everybody that what they did worked, that it revived the economy. We dodged the bullet. We dodged the crisis. We didn't have all this inflation like the Peter Schiffs were predicting. And now all they had to do was, you know, normalize interest rates and shrink their balance sheet, and everything was going to be fine. And I was like laughing, saying, oh, that's all you have to do, right? That's impossible to do. It can never be done. But it was only because people believed that QE could successfully be unwound and that normal interest rates could be normalized. That's why the dollar rallied. That's why gold fell, because the markets began, you know, pricing that in. They began looking forward beyond the QE to the QT, beyond the 0% rates to a normalization. Well, when the Fed goes back to zero, when the Fed does more QE, I don't believe anybody is going to be dumb enough to believe that the Fed is going to be able to normalize rates or shrink their balance sheet. I mean, I've overestimated the intelligence of the investing public for a long time, but I can't believe that they could be that dumb, right? Because if the Fed couldn't shrink a $4.5 trillion balance sheet, how are they going to shrink an $8 or a $10 trillion right. balance sheet?
Right.
If the Fed could normalize interest rates, right? If the highest they got was 2.25, 2.5, when the national debt was $22 trillion, how are they going to do it when it's $30 trillion
right.
or $40 trillion? So when people realize that there is no way out, that it is a monetary roach motel, which is something they should have realized from the beginning, but maybe they had a vested interest in refusing to see it.
Right.
But at that point, you know, the Fed is not going to be able to pretend that this is just temporary. This is permanent debt monetization, right? Ben Bernanke himself lied about that to Congress in 2009. I was the only person who really publicly called him out when he told Congress that he wasn't monetizing the debt, that the Fed wasn't monetizing the debt. It was simply buying bonds temporarily until the crisis was over. I said at the time, that's a lie. None of these bonds are ever going to get sold. They're going to stay on the balance sheet because it's impossible to get rid of them. And I was right.
Mm-hmm.
They're still there, right? So this is banana republic style government finance through a printing press. It's inflation. I mean, people are looking forward to this modern monetary theory. That's what we got. We got that nonsense. We're financing the government permanently by creating money. And when people realize this and how it's going to have to constantly get bigger, because the more debt we have in the economy, the bigger the bubble is, the more debt we need to sustain it.
Right.
Right? We just got those GDP numbers for all of last year, all of 2018, and we got 2.9% growth in GDP. Well, the last time we had 2.9% growth in GDP was in 2015, not that long ago, 3 years earlier. But in that calendar year, the national debt increased by $850 billion. In 2018, it increased by $1.5 trillion. So we're having to borrow a lot more money to get the GDP to grow. Well, I mean, obviously, the bigger it gets, the more and more we have to borrow. So it's impossible to sustain this, right? And so inevitably, the markets are going to see this, and this is going to end the only way it could, which is in a currency crisis. Not just a financial crisis, but a currency crisis, a U.S. dollar crisis, and by definition, a sovereign debt crisis, right? The market still doesn't get it. The treasury market is rising, right? We've got this inverted yield curve now. You've got people buying bonds because they are correctly anticipating that the U.S. economy is headed to recession.
Right.
And that is the reflexive move. If you're a bond trader, oh, the economy is weakening, we buy bonds, right? Because that means the Fed's going to ease. That means usually people think it means less inflation.
Dollar-denominated bonds.
Yes, because – The only thing worse than having a dollar today is being paid a dollar tomorrow,
right.
And that's what U.S. Treasuries are. They're dollars in the future,
right.
And you get a little bit of interest for holding off, right? For waiting to spend, right? You can spend your dollars today, or you can wait to spend them in 10 years, and we'll give you a little bit of interest. That's all you have when you have a bond. But what's going to happen this next recession? And if I'm right, and I think I am right about it, but if you know, the markets lose confidence in the Fed and they lose confidence in their ability to reverse the policy in the future, and the dollar really starts to tank, interest rates are going to be forced higher. Inflation, consumer prices are going to be forced higher. So rising deficits, money printing, inflation, this is terrible for bonds. This is toxic. If bond traders really understood what this next recession means, they would be selling bonds, not buying them. But this is not in their playbook right now. They don't think that many moves ahead.
Right.
So this is a real opportunity. This is a real gift horse for people to get rid of their bonds. And I would imagine that foreign central banks around the world that are still holding on to U.S. they're selling. I mean, anybody that has a lot of bonds, this is your get-out-of-jail-free card. And, of course, if you have short-term bonds, you don't even have to sell. Just don't roll them over. Just let them mature
right. And
get your money back. And then when you get your dollars back, sell, you know, while the dollar index is still as high as it is, because the dollar is going to fall through a trap door once, you know, somebody acknowledges that the emperor has no clothes. I mean, somebody other than me.
Do you think it's just a question of, like, when I think about the media's role in this, do you think it has anything to do with the fact that, like, the financial media kind of keeps score of things on a day-to-day basis, and you really, you know, you have to use, you know, 5% of your brain here to understand that this is maybe a little bit more of a longer-term perspective that you need to have on things going forward to understand the viewpoint that you're coming from and, you know, the viewpoint that I put out there, right? Like, this stuff probably isn't going to happen tomorrow, but it doesn't mean it's that far off.
Yeah, I mean, that's always the problem, you know, when you're a contrarian. I mean, you're technically wrong until you're right.
Right.
But if you're ultimately right, then you're right the entire time. You're not wrong. You're just, you know, you're just early, right? And, of course, famous last words, right? I mean, you know, it's the people who think they're right that are actually wrong. I mean, if you are buying into the U.S. stock market because you think that everything is great, you're making money, but you're wrong. Now, if you're in the U.S. stock market because you know it's a bubble and you know that there are a lot of problems, but you just think you're smart enough to get out in time, well, you know, maybe you're a great trader, or maybe, you know, maybe you've got, you know, you're doing something right. But most of the people who are in U.S. investments are clueless. They're long for the wrong reasons, and the reason that they look like they're right is because everybody else is making the same mistakes that they are. And that, you know, you can go back and look at the prior bubbles, you know, in the dot-coms. You know, there were people, myself included, who were very critical of these stocks and their business models and their valuations, you know, in 1997, 1998, 1999, 2000. And, you know, what people used to say is, yeah, but look at how much money I'm making. Yes, how long have you been saying that, Peter? You said that when the stock was at 10 and now it's at 100. Right. But then the stock went to zero. So who was right? Was I right to criticize it at 10, even though it went to 100, if it eventually went to zero? You know, now, to the extent that someone got in at 10 and got out at 20 or 30 or 100, yeah, well, you know, they timed the market right. But there are a lot of people that didn't get out. In fact, most people didn't. You know, the money just evaporated. And you know, the same thing is going to happen again. This is a much bigger bubble. It encompasses far more than just dot-coms or housing. I mean, how many years did people make fun of me because I was renting my house? And, you know, renting houses and then ultimately short the subprime market. But, you know, it took several years before the real estate market imploded. Now, was I wrong when I was saying there was a real estate bubble in 2002 or 3 or 4? No, I wasn't wrong. The people who were wrong were the people who said it wasn't a bubble. Just because the bubble got bigger didn't mean I was wrong for spotting it or understanding the dynamics behind it. And, you know, so, but yeah, I mean, a lot of people just want to grade you on, oh, well, what happened last quarter? I mean, that's going to burn a lot of people. That's one of the reasons that indexing and mindless investing has been so popular, because the people who have been able to make the most money have been the people who have been foolishly long and haven't really thought objectively about what they were buying. And so, you know, when people buy these index funds and the index funds buy all the overvalued stocks, and then the overvalued stocks go up, and then the index funds are outperforming, you know, active managers, and now more people invest in the rearview mirror. So they send more money into these index funds, which now have to go out and buy the same overpriced stocks that they already own. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of good value investors, you know, have gone out of business over the last, you know, several years or 5 years or, you know, because they really can't attract money because they can't compete with these indexes because they're too smart to buy this stuff. Or, you know, it's hard to buy something when you know it's going to implode because you don't want to get caught with it when the music stops. The problem is the music plays for a lot longer than you think.
Right.
But when it finally stops, that's it. And, you know, there's no chairs. Or,
right.
So – And you know, I think we're going to have the last laugh. And again, the last two times the bubble popped, the Fed came to the rescue of all the people who were oblivious to the problems. It's not going to work next time, because when the Fed tries to rescue the asset markets and the banks, it's going to destroy the dollar. There's no other way to do it, because when they go back to zero again and they go to QE, it's not going to work. And, you know, the bailouts were working so long as people had confidence in the bailer, which was the U.S. government, the Federal Reserve. Well, the next time, there's going to be no confidence in the U.S. government or the Federal Reserve. It's the crisis is going to be centered around the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury. So when the dollar and treasuries are the crisis, then there's no bailouts. It's every man for himself, you know, which is why I'm telling people, you know, make sure you own gold. Make sure, you know, you have money in assets in countries that have sounder economies that are not dependent on debt and that have savings and exports and less, you know, more freer markets than we do or a few other nations. And make sure you own assets that give you yield in the right currencies. And, you know, I buy stuff. Don't buy overpriced assets. I mean, don't buy the hype and the momentum. Buy good value that will, you know, guard your wealth through this crisis that's coming, because it's, you know, it's going to be worse than the last two, and no one's getting bailed out. You know, you got to bail yourself out in advance by not getting into these problem investments in the first place.
And then you look at the media and you wonder, like, why they don't get it when they're the same people that don't have the nuance to understand, like, for example, you're talking before about your company Shift Gold, that, you know, your company was a result of your firmly held belief in the strategy of owning gold and not the other way around, right? That's a very simple concept. People that can't even get that, I mean, how do you expect them to understand this complex argument that's going to require more than 10 seconds of their attention span?
Yeah, and look, the easiest thing to do in the investment community is sell your clients exactly what they want, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's much harder to educate them with respect to what they should be doing, not simply giving them what they want to do. Because in most cases, individual investors want to do the wrong thing at the wrong time. I mean, if you think about, you know, the whole idea behind buying low and selling high, you know, I'm not talking about from a day trading perspective, but I'm talking about over the long cycles of businesses and companies, right? And if you want to buy low and sell high, you can't buy low if you're buying what everybody else is buying.
Right. Right.
I mean, if everybody else is buying it, if everybody agrees that it's a great deal and it's great, then it can't be cheap. Right? It's going to be expensive.
Right.
So you have to find a situation where everybody hates something, but maybe you figure out that they're wrong. That, you know what, I know they hate it because it's gone down and because things are not doing well right now, but you got to look beyond that to, hey, what's happening beneath the surface that all these people who are so afraid of this business don't see, and how this thing can turn around so I can buy it when it's out of favor and undervalued and wait until all of a sudden it's doing things that are good and all of a sudden, you know, the situation has turned around. Because when everything is great, well, I mean, what do you got to look forward to? Well, when it's not great, right? If it's never been better, well, then it probably won't be, right? I mean, so it's set up, people are set up for disappointment. But if you expect bad things to happen, well, then what would surprise you is when good things happen. So, and the same thing, you know, happens with, you know, these bigger global macro calls that I'm making. They're contrarian calls. You know, if everybody believes that the U.S. market is the best place to be, if everybody believes that the U.S. is the cleanest dirty shirt in a hamper, well, everyone around the world is loading up on U.S. assets. Okay, fine. Are they always going to think that? I don't think so. I mean, we've got more debts than anybody. We've got a bigger bubble than anybody. And the problem is we run these massive trade deficits. This last year was the biggest trade deficit ever. And, of course, it would be even worse if we didn't have the fracking industry that we had in oil. And I actually think
right.
that there's going to be a lot more problems in that industry than people believe.
There already are.
I think fracking hasn't – yeah, because fracking hasn't been the big boom to investors.
Correct.
Because a lot of money went into fracking.
Correct.
And I put money into it myself, and so I know this from experience. That, you know, we were all excited back in 08 and 09 and 010 when we were fracking these wells. And there were a lot of projections as to what it would cost and how much production there would be. Well, it cost a hell of a lot more than we thought, and the wells produced a lot less. And so, you know, I think a lot of that money, you know, ended up being malinvestment. So I don't think it's sustainable. We're going to be importing a lot more oil than we think. And so, but because of the production we have now, we our trade deficits are smaller than they otherwise would be, but they're still a record. I mean, if you look at the trade deficits X-ing out oil, these things are off the charts. And so if we're running almost $1 trillion a year in trade deficits, we need people dumb enough to think that America is the best place to invest, because we count on our trading partners taking those dollars that they earn by selling us stuff, and they have to use those dollars to buy assets in the United States. They have to buy stocks, they have to buy bonds, they have to buy real estate, because they're not buying products, because we're not making the products. They're making the products, right? And we're buying them on credit. But when all of a sudden people realize that, wait a minute, the U.S. market is very expensive, the returns are going to be low, right? There's much better values internationally or in emerging markets. Oh, the dollar is peaked, the dollar is going down, U.S. bonds are going down. When foreigners don't want to invest in the United States, then what happens? How do we recycle these trade deficits? How do we continue to live beyond our means if we can't, you know, issue the IOUs? Because then all of a sudden foreigners, they don't want to invest their dollars. They want to spend them. They want to buy stuff, right? Not investment products, but stuff that they can consume right now, right? Products that we have in this country that can be put on boats and shipped over to Asia or someplace else. And, you know, so that's when the collapse comes. That's when all the inflation that we've been exporting comes back, you know, on our shores like a tsunami. It's like these chickens, because for decades we've been exporting paper and importing stuff. Well, the reversal of that is our paper comes back and the stuff leaves. And that's, you know, going to be a substantial decline in our standard of living, because the cost of living is going way up, as a lot of the goods that we, you know, take for granted are not here anymore. You know, and we get a bunch of paper back. But the paper doesn't have any real value. I mean, right. What good are the dollars if we can't buy it? We don't produce anything.
So I want to go back to something that you said earlier. And, you know, you said that you recommend to your clients 5 to 10% of their portfolio in gold. So I have two questions off that, and then I have an additional question about gold after this. But the first question is that a strategy that you adhere to personally, or is that your strategy for your clients?
No, it's something I recommend, and I actually am probably a little light on the physical right now because I'm so overweighted in the shares, right? I have a lot of gold mining stocks, and over the last, you know, I guess 10 years, I'd probably be better off if I just had the physical. Now, I have some stocks. I own some gold stocks that have done very, very well, that are a lot higher, you know, 5 times higher, some 10 times higher than what I paid years ago. But I have a lot of gold stocks that I own, too, that are lower than they were, you know, 5, 10 years ago. So, you know, stocks, gold stocks have had a rough time. And one of the reasons for that is because the cost of mining has gone up so much, you know, and the price of gold really hasn't gone up as much as it should, given the increase in production. A lot of it, of course, is driven by the very inflationary policies that investors don't seem to recognize. But I still think that gold stocks are so cheap right now based on the psychology of investors with respect to gold and their outlook for the future price of gold. Because most people think that the price of gold is going to fall. And so when investors are looking at gold stocks, they assume that they're going to be even less profitable, or the losses are going to be even bigger, because if you think gold's going to go to 1,000 or 500, well, I mean, you're going to be super bearish on these gold stocks. And so I think they are incredibly inexpensive. So right now, personally, I have a much higher weighting to gold stocks than what I would typically have or typically recommend. In fact, I have more in gold stocks personally than I ever recommend to anybody, because I recognize that there's a lot of risk there, and I generally don't advise that people take on that much risk, given the nature of gold mining and given the fact that, you know, I need to be right. I mean, in order for you to make a lot of money in gold stocks, I basically have to be right in my thesis. I mean, one of the reasons that I've, you know, recommended foreign stocks the way I have, and is that I don't think I have to be right for my investors to ultimately beat the U.S. market. Obviously, they're not going to beat the U.S. market every year, or, you know, or even for periods greater than that, which has been the case recently. Although my strategy did a lot better than U.S. stocks from 2002 through 2011. So it just depends on, you know, when, you know, what period of time, you're investing abroad versus investing in the U.S. But the reason that I think that investing in foreign stocks that have nothing to do with gold mining, one of the reasons I like that is because I think even if I'm wrong about the U.S. economy being in so much trouble and wrong about a major crisis coming, that doesn't mean that foreign stocks are a bad investment. That doesn't mean that you can't make money being bullish on certain countries, even if your bearishness on the U.S. turns out to be wrong. Because I find that if you look around the world, you can get a better deal, that stocks in general have lower price-earnings ratios and higher dividend yields outside the United States. And I think if you simply look back at the U.S. dollar ever since we went off the gold standard in 1971 and just look at a long-term chart of the dollar, it's going down. So over longer periods of time, the dollar is likely to go down, not up. Therefore, you're likely to do better investing outside the U.S. than inside. And if foreign stocks are cheaper, if they're better values and that you pay less for the same amount of earnings and you get paid higher dividends by being invested internationally, then I think that even if I'm wrong, my clients over the long run can end up doing better than just being in U.S. stocks. But if I'm right, I think these portfolios won't go as up as much as gold stocks will, but they'll go up a lot. And I think they will go up enough to make up for the loss of purchasing power that investors would otherwise suffer if they just remained in the U.S. stock market.
Well, that's,
you know, that's why my approach has not been, hey, stay in cash, short the market. I've just recommended alternative investment strategies that I think, you know, are going to do well, but they're not completely contingent on me being right about this economic collapse that
right.
that I see coming. Now, I think I'm right about it, but I want to have, you know, okay, what if I'm wrong, you know?
Well, that dovetails beautifully into my next question, which is, you know, explain maybe to the layperson, right? Say somebody has a $10,000 portfolio, right? And they put 10% of that portfolio, they buy $1,000 worth of gold, you know, in today's dollars with today's purchasing power, and we do suffer a currency crisis, right? You know, obviously you think that the price of the commodity is going to adjust to the loss of the purchasing power of the dollar, right? So gold will appreciate if it's being measured in U.S. dollars as purchasing power diminishes. Where does the extra kind of premium come from there? Does it come from people?
Well, I think that there will be an extra premium in that I think that gold will ultimately be remonetized or you'll have a big increase in the demand for gold. So I think you can see gold prices rise by more than the price of, you know, weed or, you know, oil or, you know, any commodity that you would buy with your gold. So I do think that people will end up increasing their overall purchasing power by owning gold, just because I think gold is underpriced right now relative to a lot of other commodities and relative to certainly the amount of fiat currencies that have been created in the last decade or so, you know, since the financial crisis, you know, how much we've increased the supply of, you know, fiat currency versus how much more mined gold has been mined. So, but that's why I say, you know, gold is a way to preserve your wealth. It's
right.
not, you know, you're not, it's not about getting rich. It's about avoiding going broke. I think that we could get rich owning gold stocks if I'm right. Right. And you don't have to have all your portfolio in gold stocks. You have 10-20% of your stock portfolio in gold stocks. You know, I mean if I'm wrong, I mean, you haven't completely blown yourself up. But if I'm right, I mean, these stocks can go up, you know, 20 times, you know, 50 times. So there could be some huge gainers, which I think makes it well worth the risk. I mean, most people don't own any gold stocks at all, which is one of the reasons they're so cheap, because nobody owns them. But, you know, at some point, people are going to want to buy them when they realize that, you know, that the price of gold is going to go up. And, you know, also, a lot of people wouldn't think it's crazy to have a cash position, right? People will say, oh, I have 5%, 10% in cash. Okay, well, why not just have gold instead of cash? I mean, gold
right.
is liquid.
right.
Gold to me is a lot safer because every other form of cash is just somebody else's liability.
Right.
So why not just own real money?
Right.
I mean, central banks own gold.
Right.
Gold is a reserve. So it's a reserve asset. So why not reserve your cash in real money? I mean, what's crazy about that? And in fact, if you look at the price of gold in terms of other currencies, because people forget, they view it through the prism of the U.S. dollar. But if you look at a lot of these other currencies, especially currencies that all of a sudden have a problem and they drop a lot, price of gold goes way up in that currency. So people all around the world have protected themselves from a loss of value of their currency by holding their savings in gold
right.
instead of their own local currency. So the same thing is going to happen to the dollar. Right? It's just that it's happening later to the dollar. Just like, you know, when we had the mortgage crisis, the subprime market got hit before prime. Well, the subprime currencies are getting hit before the dollar.
Exactly.
But, you know, the dollar's got the same problem. In fact, I think it actually has a bigger problem. But what's been supporting it is its role as the reserve currency. And the mystique about that and you know, the fact that it is issued by the United States, right, the major economy in the world. But, you know, perception changes very quickly. I mean, look how quickly the Soviet Union, you know, collapsed. You know, I know we still have Russia, but Russia is just another country. I mean, a lot of people don't remember the Soviet Union. I mean, I'm 56 now, so I remember the days of the Soviet Union, right? And that was a powerful block. I mean, it was a superpower. I mean, it was us versus them. I mean, no one thinks really in terms of Russia. Russia is a shadow of what the Soviet Union used to be. But I think the same future is in store for the United States. I mean, I think at one point in time, we're just going to be another country. Unfortunately.
Yeah, and when you talk about like remonetization and you talk about, you know, you just alluded there for a second about, you know, at some point, look, we're going to have to peg the currency back to gold at some point. What does that look like? Do we do that after complete and total annihilation of the currency? Do we do it as the currency's collapsing? What does the ratio look like there? I mean, what in your head, what does that look like?
Yeah. Well, if you look at other countries, right, that have had currency crises, a lot of times what they end up doing to instill confidence is they'll peg their currency to the dollar, right? They'll come up with some new regime,
right,
and they'll say, oh, we're going to peg our currency to the dollar. We're going to maintain this peg. And because they have to back it by something. They have to stabilize it.
Right, well, right.
If there's a crisis in the dollar, right, where nobody wants the dollar anymore, where people are just losing confidence and it's in free fall and prices are just going up and, you know, they're imposing wage and price controls out of desperation, but you've got all these shortages and black markets and the government is trying to instill confidence in the currency. Well, there's nothing that we can't back the dollar by the euro or the yen. I mean, there's no other currency that we can say, oh, we're going to back the dollar by, and that would make any sense. And, you know, ultimately, too, I mean, if the dollar is just a piece of paper, so if the dollar is backed by nothing, well, I mean, how are you going to back it by a euro that's backed by nothing? You know, so I think the only way that we can instill confidence in the dollar, if there is no confidence in the dollar, and there shouldn't be, and so when the markets wake up to reality, I think you've got to change the game. And you've got to change the game by saying, okay, going forward, the dollar is now as good as gold again. And this is the deal. I mean, this is the dollar. The dollar is now once again a weight of gold because that's what the dollar used to be. I mean, the legal definition of the dollar was a weight of gold. It was a measure. Like a dollar is like, you know, a unit of measure. You were measuring a quantity of gold. And if you had a certain quantity of gold, then you had $1. That's what it was. And, you know, the original Federal Reserve notes, right, were notes that were redeemable in dollars, right? They were not dollars themselves. They were notes that were payable in dollars. What were the dollars? The dollars were gold. And so, you know, before Roosevelt devalued, it was 20 ounces of gold that equaled a dollar. But by the time Richard Nixon came around, it was 35. And that's where it was because when Roosevelt devalued, they brought down the official gold weighting of the dollar from $1 was 20 ounces or 20 ounces to you needed $35 to get an ounce of gold versus 20. And so that they brought it down. But it stayed there for a long time. And, you know, Nixon devalued the dollar a couple of times slightly before eventually devaluing it to zero, where it said the dollar is worth no gold. It didn't matter how many dollars you had, right? 35, 37, 42. Right. $1,000, $1,000,000.
It didn't matter how many dollars you had or how many
Federal Reserve notes you had.
Right.
Right. You would get no dollars. You would get no actual gold for your Federal Reserve notes. But, I mean, so I think to reinstill confidence, they're going to have to go back to some, you know, ratio again. Now, where would it be? Where would the price of gold have to be today,
right,
given all the money that has been created since the, you know, early 1970s? What price would work where the government would be able to redeem the Federal Reserve notes in dollars again? I mean, how many dollars would you need to get an ounce of gold? Well, I don't know, 10,000, 20, I have no idea what that number is, but it's much, much higher than the 1,300 that it's at today.
Right.
Well, so we ever go back on a gold standard, which I think we will, the price has to be much higher in order to make it work. Now, the other way you can make it work is just have the price of everything else go way down except gold. But I, you know, politically, I don't see how that would happen. So the easiest, most painless way of doing it is to make, is to have the gold price go up instead of have the price of everything else collapse back down to where it was, you know, in the 1960s. So that's the most likely way to do it. And yeah, it's not going to happen until it has to, right? Because the politicians will never do it preemptively. That's just not in their nature.
Correct.
It's only going to happen when they've run out of other options, when there already is a crisis. Politicians don't try to avert a crisis. They simply scramble to react to it after it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And when they choose gold, which is the right choice, it's only because they've exhausted everything else that didn't work. Because when they eventually have to admit that we need a gold standard, then the party's over, right? It's like now you got a chaperone back at the prom. Because now there's somebody to make sure that the government lives within its means. That, you know, if the government wants to spend money, they have to raise taxes.
Yeah,
and they can't just borrow it and create it out of thin air.
They're great at pointing the
gold,
finger,
gold
too.
Keeps government honest, which is why the government doesn't want it, because they don't want to be honest. They want to buy votes. They want to be Santa Claus. And you can't do that if you have to have honest money. But the other part, you know, the other good news about having honest money is that you don't have these booms and busts. You have legitimate economic growth that is financed by savings and underconsumption and capital investment. And you don't have this extreme divergence between, you know, the super rich and everybody else. You have a much more vibrant middle class, and you have, you know, an easier path upward for people who are at the lower class to move to middle class or upper class. And so you don't have the type of resentment that we have today. So there's a lot of positive things that are going to happen if we can get the government back in its cage. But I think a key part of doing that to discipline them is going to be to go back to real money. But we're not going to get there until there is a currency crisis and a sovereign debt crisis. The good news is one's coming.
Yeah, if there's one thing that we've learned over the last couple of, you know, stock market bubbles – and, of course, we haven't dealt with a currency issue like this, like we're talking about. But if there's one thing we learned from the subprime crisis, if there's one thing we learned from the dot-com bubble, it's the only thing the politicians are good at are pointing the fingers afterwards and saying, wow, how did we let this happen, you know? And I want to ask you a question, though, talking about, you know, going back to talking about gold mining stocks and the difference between just preserving your wealth and, you know, actually gaining purchasing power out of the equation, right? So the whole thing winds up going bust. Where do you actually gain purchasing power? And you made a statement before like, well, you know, you might be able to get rich by owning the miners versus owning the actual commodity. And my question to you is, you know, assuming that the dollar is going to have to collapse before we repeg it to gold, which, as you're saying, you know, these people are reactive, they're not proactive. So that's probably going to be the likely scenario. I mean, what does that mean for systemic shock in terms of like, you know, does it even, is your money with your brokerage even safe at that point? Like, what's the point of owning gold stocks if this collapse in the currency is just going to absolutely wipe
everything
out?
Yeah, well, I don't think the brokerage firms are going to fail, because I simply think the Federal Reserve won't let them fail. It'll just print up enough money. All their liabilities are in paper money, so the Fed can create the paper money necessary to keep them solvent in nominal terms. And yeah, I mean, if you want to be extra safe, you know, don't have your stocks in a margin account, because, you know, there is a difference between a margin account and a cash account. Because when you, you know, hypothecate your shares to the brokerage firm and you're allowing them to loan the shares out, right? So you've moved your stocks from your own account to like an account that is run by the brokerage firm. So it's safer just to have your assets in type one, right? So it's almost like I have my money in a safety deposit box at a bank versus I'm a depositor. Because most people don't recognize that when you deposit money to bank, you're a creditor of that bank. I mean, your deposit is their liability. And so they owe you money. And so if the bank fails, you know, you may not get it back. Now, of course, now we have the government saying, well, if the bank fails and they can't pay you the money that you've loaned them, we'll pay you back. Because when you put money in a bank, you are loaning the money to that bank.
Right.
And they're not really giving you any interest right now, so it's a bad deal for the depositor. Now, maybe they give you some services, checking they don't charge, I don't know. But you're making a loan and you're taking risk. And, I wish that there was no FDIC. And that way, the depositors would be a lot more cognizant of the risks, and they would shop around, and they would reward the banks that have good balance sheets and don't make stupid loans by depositing their money there. But because the government says, hey, it doesn't matter what bank that you put where you put your money, because we're going to guarantee the account, well, then it doesn't. No one cares how much risk the banks take. So it's the government and the moral hazard that they create with the FDIC that is the reason that the banking system is so fundamentally insolvent. But the government will probably be able to prop it up by sacrificing the dollar, which is exactly the point that I'm making and why, you know, people should, you know, invest, I think, the way that I'm advising. And by the way, you know, in gold stocks, you know, it's a tough business, you know, and that's why, you know, I've got a fund, a gold fund, and the Euro Pacific Gold Fund, EPGFX, which is I would advise if people want to buy gold stocks, you know, buy my fund. I mean, it's, you know, it's done really well. I started it 5 years ago. It's been number one. I mean, I forget if it's number one now or number two or three, but it's a top fund. Morningstar gives it 5 stars. So it's a very well-managed fund. And it's not like people have made a lot of money in that fund since I started it, but they've lost a lot less than in all the other funds. You know, and this is an example of, you know, we've really destroyed the averages. I mean, you know, versus somebody who just bought, you know, an index, GDX or XAU. I mean, we've crushed that. So we've done a really good job at picking stocks, and we've done a better job than our competitors. And so I hope that continues. And so I think that's a very good way for people to buy stocks. You know, the other funds that I manage haven't done as well as the gold fund when it comes to, you know, kind of relative to their competitors. And that's because when it's just a gold stock, it's like, okay, you have to buy gold stocks. That's basically what we do. We buy gold stocks. So it's kind of apples to apples. But my other funds, I'm making global macro calls. And so I'm avoiding certain types of stocks that almost all my competitors are buying. And I'm buying other types of stocks that are being, you know, ignored. So, you know, I've been underperforming, let's say, in my global value fund or my dividend payers fund because I've been avoiding the areas that I think are going to be the most problematic. And I've been buying the types of stocks that people are ignoring because they're not doing much. But I do think that in the long run, all my funds are going to be at the top, you know, because I think the events that I'm preparing for are I'm going to be rewarded for having, you know, been patient on my allocations. But in the short run, sure, when everybody else is doing it wrong, you know, it's a voting machine. I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Everybody is buying what's overvalued, so what's overvalued keeps going up. And if right. you don't own it, then you're underperforming. But, you know, kind of in the gold stocks, there is no momentum there because, you know, no one's chasing gold stocks. So it's really just based on who does the best job of picking stocks. You know, who's doing the best homework, and if that's the case, you know, we've done it. And I can't even take credit for it personally because I don't manage it myself. I hired somebody, a guy's name is Adrian Day, and I hired Adrian because I thought that he was a really good stock picker. He'd been doing it for 30 years. He had a good track record, and he really eats, sleeps, and drinks gold the sector. So I was smart enough to hire somebody else to pick those stocks for me because I know I have no time to do it all myself. But he's done a really, really good job. You know, he's done a better job, you know, than the portfolio managers of our the funds that compete with us.
Yeah. So one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, we talk about earlier about kind of like the psychology behind people not realizing that this is a reality. You know, that equity markets do have a fair chance of falling, that the currency does have a fair chance of collapsing. And I wanted to ask you about your own podcast and see if, because you've been doing this a lot longer than I have, and you certainly have a lot more media outlets than I do. So you have a larger data set. What I want
not really, not anymore. I hardly get. You know what? Know what media I do now? I do like One American News,
RT, right?
Which is like an up and coming kind of cable channel,
right?
And so I do them, but like you know, I do like Russia Today, RT. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll see. Well, you know, as I said, and Fox Business, really. And that's, you know, and I used to, you go back to 2005, 6, and 7, right, when far fewer people knew who I was. I used to get quoted on a regular basis, like in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, you know, the Time Magazine. You know, reporters used to call me. I mean, now – once in a while I get, you know, a call, but, you know, maybe I get made two or three a year, a reporter, you know, gives me a call to ask me something, or I just did an interview. A reporter called me from South Africa. But, you know, I used to talk to the press all the time. So, you know, whatever I kind of have now, it's basically the internet. It's basically, you know, people going out of their way to listen to my podcast because they can find it directly. They're, you know, 10 years ago, if it wasn't for the, you know, cable television news, nobody would have known about me because
right.
that was the only way you would hear about people.
Right.
But now I can go directly. So, you know, you're doing the same thing as me. I might
Correct.
Probably started off with a little bit of a bigger fan base based on the years that I was, you know, acceptable on national television. And I did write a few best-selling books, New York Times bestsellers. And I did get kind of popular on YouTube from some of the videos that had, you know, million plus views. So I had a little bit of that, but I'm not getting any help from the mainstream media at this point. You know, I mean, I guess the most exposure I get, I was on the Joe Rogan podcast for 3 years,
right?
Three times. And so a lot of people heard me there, and there's a guy that's been extremely successful in the podcast world, you know? And, so he's kind of like that. He's setting the mark as far as, you know, making a name for yourself with podcasts.
He's doing exceptionally well. And this brings me to the point that I was going to ask you about, you know, which is, do you think it's a healthy thing? And do you think it could be, you think it could be a positive for, you know, our stance, your ideology, the, you know, the Austrian kind of mindset that media as a whole now, Peter, the financial media, like you're saying, right? Back in the day, if you wanted to hear what was going on in the world of finance, you had to physically buy the Wall Street Journal or you had to turn on CNBC and you had to watch it. And now the really cool thing that's happening is that content creators, people like myself, people like you that have these viewpoints that, you know, may have been shut out by the mainstream media in the past. Now we have a platform, right? We can get right to the people that want it from us, which was one of the reasons that I was inspired to start doing the podcast to begin with. You know, I had CNBC and a Fox Business News anchor sending me questions about stories. They were having trouble understanding parts of stories that they were reporting on and things that I had done research on. And I kept sending them answers to their questions, which were usually answered by, you know, looking in a 10K or just mm-hmm. doing a very nominal amount of work.
Yeah.
And I would say to them, have me on the air. I'll debate this with somebody. I want to talk this, you know, like I know this case inside and out. And it would never happen. And finally, I was just like, you know what? Like, forget this. I'm going to do it myself. Like, why am I giving you this stuff if I'm not even going to be tethered to it? You know, why am I doing your mm-hmm. job for you? I just think, you know, my question to you is, does your standpoint, does your ideology, does the Austrian kind of mindset have room to grow? And what I was going to ask you before is, are you seeing it growing on your own podcast?
Oh, there's no question that it is going to happen. I mean, obviously, you know, my popularity grew when the financial crisis of 08 hit. And a lot of the things that I had been warning about for years all of a sudden were happening. And that was a catalyst for people to, you know, start paying attention to me. And so since I'm as confident, if not even more so confident, that all of the things that I have been warning about since that crisis are going to happen, there is going to be another surge in my popularity. People are going to then learn about me, read about me. Oh, did anybody get this right? Did anybody see this coming? And, you know, a lot of people who are very critical because they keep thinking that I've gotten everything wrong, they would really be amazed to actually look at the tremendous number of things that I've actually gotten right. Not that I've gotten everything right, but there's so many things that I have said that I was forecasting, you know, years and years ago that have happened. And people are not, you know, accepting that, wait a minute, so all the stuff has happened that most people said was never going to happen or didn't have any clue was going to happen, yet it's happened the way I said it would. Maybe I'm right about everything, because a lot of these things that are happening are things that I knew would happen as part of my overall forecast that hasn't necessarily come true yet or hasn't come true yet, but a lot of pieces of the puzzle are already in place, you know, and people are not looking at how many have fallen into place and then making the leap to figure out that, you know what, maybe he's got this right.
Right.
Because a lot of people didn't think any of these pieces were ever going to happen, right? You know, so I'm not getting surprised by this stuff. I just am surprised that the Fed was able to maintain the pretense as long as it was, and that you know, the investing public around the world was as was irrational as long as they were in their ability to discover this or seek out the truth. So certainly I think that there's going to be, you know, another opportunity for me to grow my audience, grow, you know, my influence, my client base. So all that is coming. And I hope that I can be a big enough factor in swaying opinions in the future, because, you know, the left is going to have a big advantage, and they're going to be able to blame this on Trump and capitalism and tax cuts and deregulation. And even if, you know, it doesn't get bad enough in the next 2 years where Trump is out after one term, you know, it may even be worse if he manages to get reelected. You know, if things aren't bad enough that he gets reelected, because they'll be so much worse 4 years later. But I do think that the appeal of socialism is going to rise. I mean, it's now, you know, out of the closet. I mean, people are no longer embarrassed about admitting that they're socialists. I mean, a lot of Democratic politicians were closet socialists, and if they came out, they would not stay in office. But now it's almost like a badge of honor. Like, oh, if you're not a socialist, well, you're not progressive. There's something wrong with you. You're old school. You're not with the times. You know. But it is, you know, a lot more acceptable, right? People accept, you know, somebody saying they're a socialist, they're a Marxist, they're communist. It's okay, you know.
Right.
And so this next crisis, the left is going to be able to gain a lot, you know, of momentum, and they're going to be able to get a lot more people to, you know, to make that leap into that, you know, spectrum. And the Republicans haven't done themselves any favor by championing this bubble, by pretending that Trump has solved all the problems that he hasn't, right? By embracing the phony government statistics that he once criticized. You know, when this thing blows apart, they have nothing to stand on. They can't say, I told you so, because, you know, we told them everything was great. Trump said, this is the greatest economy in the history of the country, and it's all because of me and these tax cuts and the deregulation and the things that I've done. And so the minute everything falls apart, well, Trump owns that.
Right.
You know, his brand is on it. It's got to be – there's a big T on this economy, just like right. One of his buildings, you know. And unfortunately, it's going to be like one of his, you know, casinos in Atlantic City. I mean, that's what's going to happen.
Yep.
Or Trump Steaks or whatever. You know, this is going to be a flop. And, you know, he's going to take down not just himself, but what he stands for, which is capitalism or less government and all that. So at least I could be out there as one of the people who advocates freedom and limited government and, you know, less government, cutting spending, fewer regulations and all that, who did not jump on the Trump train, did not swallow the Kool-Aid, who was critical of the economy under Trump, just like I was critical of the economy under Bush. And I didn't like it, you know, going on Kudlow and, you know, listening to all these other Republicans talking about the greatest story ever told and the Goldilocks economy. I mean, you know, Larry Kudlow was just as bullish on the economy when Bush was president as he is now, you know, now that he's part of the Trump administration. But he was extremely bullish right until everything imploded, because he didn't understand that what he was championing was a Federal Reserve created bubble.
Right.
And that just running big deficits to finance tax cuts, you know, didn't mean that Bush was a great president. You know, Bush wasn't vetoing anything, just like Trump. The only thing Trump vetoed was an attempt to cut spending on the wall. I mean, he signed every spending bill that was put on his desk. And Bush did the same thing. I mean, Bush presided over an increase in the size of government, and all he did is give us a deficit finance tax cut. And, you know, what Republicans should be about is making government smaller, not making deficits bigger.
Right.
So if you want to cut taxes, then reduce the size of government. And then you can cut taxes, because the cost of government is what it spends. It's not what it taxes. And if you're just going to cut taxes but make government bigger and more expensive, the public has to pay for that. There's no free lunch. The Republicans shouldn't be the party of the free run. So the way you get taxes is by making government smaller. And when government is smaller, you're freeing resources back to the private sector. The government no longer needs to confiscate those resources if it's no longer spending the money. So you make government smaller, and then you reward the free market by reducing taxes, because government doesn't cost as much. But Bush didn't do that, and Trump's not doing that. But when you have all these Republican, columnists and commentators out there
talking about how everything is great because we cut taxes. You know, it's not. We didn't cut government ever. And we just let the Fed continue to blow more air into the bubble. But now it's a Republican bubble again. And when it pops, just like we got Obama, you know, it didn't matter who really the Democrats nominated or who the Republicans nominated in 08. I mean, McCain had no chance because he had all the Bush baggage. Well, you know, the Trump baggage is going to be much worse, especially if Trump is, you know, again at the top of the ticket. And so we'll elect a Democrat who's farther to the left than Obama was. And, you know, Obama did a lot more damage than people understand to this economy because the Fed was able to paper it over. But, you know, at the expense of making the problems much bigger.
And it's wild when you talk about, hey, like, people haven't noticed what I've gotten right. And to some degree, like, I love, you know, that video that you have on your YouTube channel, Peter Schiff is Right. It's one of my favorite things to send people and to tweet out to my followers. And I watch it, you know, probably like once a quarter just to remind myself. But also, like, people don't even need to understand that. There's an MSNBC interview of you from some years back when you were welcome on MSNBC. And you're arguing with some liberal economists and a woman liberal economist who says to you, you say to her at some point, the way to pay off debt is not to take on more debt, right? Which is like basic Econ 101 facts. Like, you don't even need to have a high school education to understand that, right? You said the way to pay off debt is not by taking on more debt. And her response to factually...
You're probably talking about a conversation that centered around raising the debt ceiling.
Right.
Somebody said, well, we need to raise the debt ceiling.
Right.
You know,
she said that's factually incorrect.
We have to pay our debts. We have to be able to, you know, pay our debts. And I said, well, you don't pay your debts by going deeper into debt, you know.
Yeah, she said that's factually incorrect. That was her rebuttal. She told you it's factually incorrect. And so, the point I'm trying to make is you don't have to go back and look at your calls on the housing crisis. You just got to tune into an interview like that and say, like, which of these two people is making sense? Like,
right.
Do I pay off debt?
But I think there's a lot of smaller things, a lot of things that have happened along the way that are things that I was warning about or forecasting would happen. It's just that all of those things haven't led to the ultimate collapse yet. We haven't had a dollar crisis.
Right.
We haven't had, you know, the U.S. bond collapse. But if you're simply going to say, well, we're going to wait until those things happen before, you know, paying any attention to what Schiff has to say. If you're going to wait for that, well, then it's too late. You know, I mean, what good is it, right? I mean, the key is to learn from what I'm saying and to act on it before everything comes true. Because once everything comes true, well, it's too late to make any money. It's too late to preserve any wealth.
Right, right.
And granted, you know, in general, people who ignored my advice, you know, over the, you know, since the financial crisis, if you ignored my advice, you probably have more money than if you followed my advice. But don't press your luck. I mean, because I'm confident that, you know, at the end of the day, that's not going to be the case. The people who ignored my advice are gonna get hurt. And, you know, sure, people have profits in the stock market, but most people won't take those profits. Those profits are going to vanish. And either they're going to vanish because people are going to lose their money, or they're going to vanish because the money is going to lose its value. But either way, you know, you're not going to have the purchasing power that you think or that you had on paper at one time. And I think that the people who have been following my advice, while they may have fewer dollars today than, you know, the ones who ignored it, you know, at the end of the day, when, you know, we do have the crisis and it is coming, then they're going to be in much, much better position than the people who have been ignoring the advice. They're going to have much higher purchasing power. They're going to have a lot more dollars, for sure, I think, and they're going to be able to have a much greater purchasing power than the people who, you know, who have ignored it. And on paper now, oh, that looks like it was the right move, until it's not. And again, it was the same way when the 08 crisis happened or the 2000. It's just that the people that got it wrong got bailed out. You know, well, you know, just don't count on that happening again.
And just going back to what you were talking about with Trump before, you know, you were talking about, hey, these fabricated numbers that are made up, you know, or these, you know, tweaked numbers like CPI. I mean, one of my viewers asked me to ask you what you think the real level of inflation is in the U.S. If you were, you know, obviously you don't buy the CPI number.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do think it is – considerably higher. And again, the real rate of inflation, it has to do with money supply growth, not prices going up. But I think that prices are rising to a greater degree than is being captured by the CPI. How much greater, I don't know, right? But I just don't think that the CPI is a very accurate way to measure prices. And I think it's, you know, it's that way by design. You know, if you go back to the Boskin Commission in the 90s, that was the goal. They basically said, we believe that the CPI is overstating inflation, and we're going to change the methodology for calculating it so that we get a lower number. So they deliberately, you know, made some changes to produce lower numbers. Now, personally, I don't think that the government was right. I think the CPI that we used to use is probably a better measure than the one we use today. But I remember I did one experiment myself, and I made a YouTube video of it, and this was back in 2013. And basically what I did is I said, okay, let's take a look at one price that is in the CPI, and it's newspapers and magazines. And the category in the 10 years from 2003 to 2013, the category showed a 30% increase over a 10-year period. And I said, well, all right, well, let me just see, because newspapers and magazines, the prices are written right on the cover.
Right.
So it's pretty easy to see, like, what the New York Times sold for, what Time magazine sold for, what Newsweek sold for, you know, what the Wall Street Journal sold for. Just take a look at an image on the internet of that paper from that era, right? So I took about, I think, the 20 or 30 top circulated newspapers and magazines and priced every one of them and created an average. And the number I got was about 130% increase over the 10 years. Well, the CPI said it was only 30%. Well, that's a big difference. So right. The question is, you know, how does that happen? I mean, how do these numbers go into the CPI and come out in such a way
right. That
you take 130% increase and it's only 30%? So, you know, it is not being honest. It's like, you know, hiring the mafia to, you know, keep the statistics on crime. Obviously, they don't want people to think crime is going up because they don't want more cops on the street. They just assume have people think there's no crime. So the statistics don't show any crime. Well, the government doesn't want any evidence of inflation, so they cover it up, especially now since they're trying to justify their money printing by saying we don't have enough inflation. So first they convince us it's not there by lying to us, and then they say, oh, look, inflation's only 1.5%. We need more of it, even though if they reported it honestly, it might be 4%. So they cheat, they report a phony number, and then they say we need more inflation because it's not high enough. But, you know, the other reason that the measured level of prices are not much higher, and they're going to be much higher in the future, in the near future, is because of the trade deficit, right? It's because we are able to export all of that money, a lot of that money that we print, and we're able to import stuff that we didn't make. And so in order to see prices going up, you need more money chasing fewer goods. Well, if the money leaves and the goods come in, the supply of goods is growing. We're sending the money we print abroad, and so that's keeping the price of goods down. Now, what happens to that money we send abroad? It comes back to our financial markets. It buys bonds, it buys stocks, it buys real estate, and so those prices are going up. So the reason that we have a high stock market and a high bond market, a real estate market, that's inflation. The money that has been created has been bidding up financial assets while consumer goods have been kept in check
right. By
all the imports. So that process is going to be reversed. And then all of a sudden, it's like a catch-up. A lot of the inflation that we've been exporting all of a sudden hits us, you know. And it's going to be very brutal because it's going to be all at once. It's a big lag between the creation of the money and the impact that that's going to have on consumer prices. And, of course, you know, one of the commodities that's going to be impacted the most is going to be the price of gold. Price of gold, I think, will go up a lot more, and the price of silver will probably go up more than the price of gold. So that's why people should be owning these metals, because if you have gold, right, in the future you'll be able to buy more stuff because for you prices are going to go down, right? If you're saving in gold, prices will be lower in terms of gold in 10 years than they are today. But if your savings are in dollars, prices are going to be much, much, much higher.
Yeah, why, real quick, I have one final question for you, but I just want to quickly just touch on what you just said right there. Why do you think the price of silver will go up more relative than the price of gold? in that situation?
Well, it just historically tends to happen that way. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean it's always going to happen, but, you know, I mean, things tend to repeat. And, you know, during prior big bull markets in gold, you've had even bigger bull markets in silver. So, you know, I would just, you know, assume that that's going to happen again, you know. So, I mean, maybe it'll be different this time, but usually it's not. So, I mean, if you're bullish on gold, the way if gold's going to go to 5,000, you know, what's that? It's not even five times where it is, right?
Yeah.
So if gold moved up five times, you know, I would expect silver to move up, you know, 10 times, 20 times, you know, I mean, something like that. I mean, just based on historic moves. And if you look at where silver is now, just if silver gets back to, you know, 50, where it was, you know, in 2011, I mean, gold's peak was 1900.
Right.
I mean, you know, I mean, so gold's not even that far off, 1300, 1900. I mean, silver, what's silver, $14?
Yeah, you know? Somewhere around there.
I mean, so, you know, just to return to its prior high, you know, silver's got to more than triple, and gold just has to go up, what, 50% or do the math, 40%?
Right. Yeah, about 50%. So, all right, yeah. So for my last question, Peter, and I appreciate you being very generous with your time, I want to ask you to kind of take off your economist hat and put on your political hat, because as a former political candidate, I know you have a political hat, and
I was a one-time candidate, didn't go very far. I was too honest.
Yeah, I think that was the problem, actually. You know, the one thing I wanted to ask you about was what your thoughts were on this collusion story and, you know, how bad you think the media screwed itself on this story of collusion and where you kind of stand on it personally.
Yeah, look, I mean, I always thought it was a bunch of nonsense. First of all, anything that the Russians did to help, you know, make sure we didn't elect Clinton, they did us a favor, you know. I mean, but, you know, and it's not like, you know, America doesn't interfere with foreign elections. Of course we do. I mean, we decide if we think our politicians think a particular, you know, individual is in our best interest to be elected, and we
right.
will do what we can to influence that election. And so to the extent that Russia decided to influence the U.S. election, to the extent that they did, and that kept Hillary out of the White House, then, yeah, we should send them a thank you for that. And I, because I do think that, I mean, I do think Trump is better than what Hillary would have done. I think the most damage that Trump will end up doing is because he may help to further blame capitalism and tarnish an already, you know, tainted reputation based on the fact that he has embraced this bubble and is being so disingenuous with respect to, you know, the economy. I mean, he was much more honest as a candidate, except as a candidate, he didn't really come out with any solutions to the problems because the solutions may have been unpalatable to voters, but he, at least he brought up the problems, but he doesn't, you know, he's not doing that now. But look, I doubt that the Trump organization colluded with the Russians in some type of orchestrated way in order for the Russians to influence the election. You know, I would have imagined that whatever the Russians did, they did on their own. And, you know, and he obviously ran a very good campaign the way he did it. Obviously, just look at the results. That speaks for itself. I mean, and if you look at the amount of money he spent, which was, you know, relative to what Hillary spent, you know, he was very economical. But again, that's what I said earlier in the podcast. I mean, Trump gets a lot of criticism for the wrong reasons. I mean, there's plenty of things that you could be critical of the president of, but most of the stuff he's being accused of doing is a bunch of nonsense. And so, yeah, I mean, and the media loves to, you know, they want to, oh, we're going to impeach the president, you know, for this or that. Well, and, you know,
my question I'm kind of alluding to is, you know, is the coming financial crisis going to do to the financial media what this collusion story has done to the mainstream political media?
I don't think so. Look, the mainstream media, I mean, as when it comes to the left, I mean, you know, look what happened with the Supreme Court nominee. Was
what, a Kavanaugh?
Kavanaugh, right. I mean, so look at what happened with Kavanaugh.
I thought I lost you there for
a second. Look at what happened. Look at what happened, you know, with the Covington High School kids. Look at what happened with Jussie Smollett, or, you know, what are all this nonsense that they jump on that is later exposed. I mean, it doesn't seem to hurt the media in the eyes of, you know, the left, or, you know, the people that, you know, are just trying to advance their agenda. I think the right, or conservatives, Republicans, already held the media in pretty low regard. And so I think a lot of these fiascos recently simply confirmed what a lot of people already thought about the media anyway. But what I think is going to happen is, I think that when this economy collapses, see, a lot of people in the media are going to be able to say, I told you so. And they're going to be wrong about it, but they're going to be able to say it. You know, because they're going to say, you see, we told you that tax cuts for the rich were going to hurt the economy.
Right.
And it may not be the tax cuts for the rich that did it, but it'll be something that the Democrats can blame, because Trump did cut taxes for the rich, said everything would be great, and everything was a disaster instead. And it's going to make it easier to, you know, advance the false narrative that Bush wrecked the economy with tax cuts and deregulation, and Obama came in, a Democrat, and fixed what Bush broke. He created the recovery by raising taxes on the rich and doing whatever he did, right, you know, to create the recovery. And then he turned over the reins to another Republican who immediately cut taxes again on the rich, right, and drove that car right back into the same ditch that Obama got it out of.
Right.
And now here we are again. And now we should learn that this doesn't work, that capitalism, that Republicans and tax cuts doesn't work, and we need to go back to big government and higher taxes and central planning and all this. So the media, I think, has been handed a victory because, you know, they were very critical of Trump and Trumponomics, and now they're going to get to be vindicated. That's the big problem. That's why this is not just a financial crisis or a currency crisis or an economic crisis. This is a political crisis, and the political crisis is going to be not only that we could elect socialists, but they're going to pass socialist legislation to try to solve the problem that socialist legislation created, and we're going to dig ourselves into a deeper hole. Our last line of defense may be the Supreme Court, and hopefully that's where Trump can really make a difference with his Supreme Court appointments, you know, just mentioning Kavanaugh, the other, you know, if we can get enough people on the Supreme Court that we start declaring this stuff unconstitutional. If a lot of the programs that the next president in Congress enact, big government programs, you know, if they get struck down like a lot of Roosevelt's programs were struck down initially, then that could save us. And that's why the Democrats are already talking about stacking the Supreme Court. They're talking about getting additional justices on there so they can dilute the impact of the Trump appointments.
Yeah, well, Peter, listen, I honestly hope we get to see you on Joe Rogan again. It's one of my favorite podcasts, and he's got such a insane viewership now. I mean, it's a million views, you know, overnight. If you go on.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, I might reach out to him. I'm going to be out in Vegas in May. You know, I'm doing the Money Show again. That's one of the things I still do. I do these conferences. So I'm doing the Vegas Money Show in May.
Okay.
And then I'm hanging around for a few more days, and I'm doing the Skybridge Alternative Asset Conference.
Okay.
That's Anthony Scaramucci's, conference in Vegas. That's always a good time as well. So the last couple of times I did Joe Rogan, it was when I was out for one of those conferences, and so I just went over to LA because it's very close to Vegas, and so I might reach out, and I'll be back in Vegas again in July because that's when they do the Freedom Fest, and I do that conference, and so I still do these. I do the New Orleans conference every year. You know, I just got back from this investment cruise that I was part of, Real Estate Guys. So I still do some of that. You know, it's just kind of the mainstream media. By the way, what they're going to have me doing at the SALT conference is I agreed to do a gold versus Bitcoin debate. So I guess they had to find somebody. Although Mary Rubini is going to be there. He's been a pretty big critic of Bitcoin, but he hasn't been a big backer of gold. So I guess, you know, I could defend the hard money and criticize Bitcoin at the same time. So.
Well, I think in terms of, you know, what I was saying before about content creators kind of being able to create their own media now and, you know, not really having to be beholden to the networks and to these major media massive corporations, Rogan is a perfect example. And if I can play the role of your PR advisor for 15 seconds, if you'd let me, my advice to you would be to get on there as much as possible, because it's one of the best ways for the world to kind of get your message and get your perspective, which I think we desperately need. And of course,
yeah, and I look, you know, I go on there and I see some of the comments too, because they, you know, you can see the podcast they put on YouTube. And yeah, I mean, you know, people usually either really like me or totally hate me. So, you know, you can at least say, and again, that's when going back to the beginning of the podcast where Guy Dami said on bad television, that's what makes good television. I mean, people want to see me on television because they like what I have to say,
right,
or they think I'm a complete fool and they can't wait to see the next stupid thing that I say.
Right, right.
I mean, so, you know, people like to watch me on television, whether they agree with me or not.
Right.
I mean, that's what makes for good television. People will watch people they don't like just because they want to see the stupid things that they say so that they can react to it. You know, but if someone's just going to be boring and just regurgitate the economy is great, buy the S&P, my price target is X, I mean, that's what's dull. That's why, you know, the ratings are down. So, you know, that to have somebody who's controversial that – you know, that sparks some emotion from the audience, you know, some either it's like, oh, I love this guy, he's great, or I hate this guy, he's an ass. You know, that's what's entertaining on talk. And, you know, I would do Rogan more often. I mean, obviously, it's his choice what guests he has. But, you know, his policy is you have to be in studio. And, you know, I spend most of my time in Puerto Rico right now, so it's pretty far from Southern California.
Somebody wanted me to ask you, are there any negatives to living in Puerto Rico? We talked last time about, you know, how great the capital gains were there. Is it real quick, is there anything negative about living there?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's negatives about living anywhere, right? I mean, nothing is perfect, but I mean, the positives far outweigh the negatives. I mean, I enjoy living here. So, I mean, is everything perfect? No, but nothing was perfect in Connecticut either. So, you know, you got to look at, and I lived in California, I've lived in Florida, I've lived in Manhattan, you know, and I lived all over California, Northern, Southern California. So I would say that overall, I'm enjoying living here more than I've enjoyed living anyplace else.
Beautiful. Well,
so, you know, is it perfect? No. Are there certain things that I miss about other places? Yes. But overall, I guess overall lifestyle, I really like it down here. And the fact that I'm hardly paying any taxes, well, then I like it a lot more. And I can afford to like it a lot more because I get to keep a lot more of my money.
Right. Well, listen, Peter, honestly, I hope that, you know, when the unfortunately, when a lot of people get smacked during this next crisis that we have, which, you know, is an inevitability, and your popularity again goes through the roof, whether it's for the good reasons or for the bad reasons or both. Hopefully, I'd love to have you back on as well. And I do, again, want to thank you so much for coming on, because in the grand scheme of things, Joe Rogan, I am not. And so you risk a lot of, you know, your...
All right, well, Joe Rogan didn't start off as Joe Rogan either, so hopefully you'll keep growing your audience and, you know. All right.
Thank you so much, Peter. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was the one, the only Peter Schiff, and really, Peter risks a great deal of his credibility by coming on here, because to some degree I am still relatively unknown, and I don't even think he knew who I was when I first started inviting him on the podcast, and I'm not sure he still knows who I am now, but... I'm really appreciative of him coming on, and certainly my favorite perspective to hear, one of my favorites, so does well to stroke my internal confirmation bias as well. Want to thank you guys so much again for tuning in, and especially thank you to those of you who have contributed to my Patreon and are recurring supporters of the podcast, because if we're going to take this thing to the next level and we're going to get to a point where we're making a real impact on the financial media over the course of the long term, and we want to open up a lot of minds and we want to kind of get people to think a little bit differently about things, it's you guys that continue to support the podcast that really continue to keep me after it. And I appreciate that very much. And I know my listeners all appreciate that very much. It is Sunday. And for right now, I am the fuck out. Peace.